welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about The Turn of the Screw by Henry James. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. Our guest is Lorraine Murphy, a professor of English at Hillsdale College. She's podcasted with us many times on everything from Jane Austen to Jane Eyre, and most recently on The Dubliners by James Joyce. She joins us in the studio as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station, WRFH in Michigan. Lorraine, welcome back to the Great Books Podcast.
My great pleasure. Thank you, John.
Why is The Turn of the Screw by Henry James a great book?
Well, James himself said that wonder is the source of our love of story, and that the ghost story perhaps most directly taps into that. He said that we love to be mystified, and this story definitely succeeds in accomplishing that. He also referred to it as an excursion into chaos, bounded by the form of the fairy tale with a remarkable unity of design. And I think that's quite right. And finally, he described it, I'm just using James to praise the story, but he described it as a labyrinth. And I think that is just the perfect image for what it feels like to read this story.
We're going to talk about all of that, the mysteries of this story, the ghosts, whether there are ghosts, the wonder, the characters, and a lot more. But let's begin with the framing narrative. There is a ghost story here, but there's a framing narrative. It's Christmas Eve, and a group of people are telling ghost stories. Lorraine, first remind us what is a framing narrative, and then tell us what's going on here.
A framing narrative is a really interesting device that introduces the story and sometimes then provides an epilogue to the story. In this case, we do not have an end, another side of the frame, if you will. But the framing narrative introduces the story and determines for us how we are to read. It sets up some themes or questions that we're meant to carry into our encounter with the story proper. In this case, we have a very atmospheric situation where friends at a country house are telling these stories. One of them tells a story of a ghost appearing to a child, and another, named Douglas, says, well, what would you think of a ghost appearing to two children? And he creates this great eagerness in the characters in the story, in the audience, to hear this story.
And then Douglas does what?
He can't tell it. It's interesting. He has to send for a manuscript that's locked away that was left him on the death of a governess of these two children. And our narrator explains that this manuscript is now in his hands following the death of Douglas. So this is an eerie introduction. You have these, you know, storytellers who have passed on the story. They're now dead. The other thing that's interesting about it is it's supposed to be a storytelling situation around the fire, but Douglas has to read the story. And T.J. Lustig, who has written really interestingly on this story in a book called Henry James and the Ghostly, said that there's this kind of connection between ghosts and writing, that both ghosts and writing kind of summon what is past or what is not present.
So this introduces the story, The Turn of the Screw. And we think of The Turn of the Screw, then it's the manuscript, basically, that our friend Douglas reads. And this involves a governess. Who is she, and what situation does she find herself in?
She's young and sheltered. She's the daughter of a country parson. She's sort of never seen the world. And she is hired by the children's uncle, who gives her a very strange sort of set of responsibilities. He says, go to my country house, take care of the two children there, and don't lean on me for anything. I don't want to hear from you. I don't want to hear about them. You just take over. So she's very eager to please this uncle, which is an aspect of the story that some readers find very important, that she's sort of attracted to him without saying so, that she really wants to sort of shine in his eyes. She's also perhaps elated by the power that's given to her. She's very inexperienced, well-meaning, but inexperienced. She goes down to the country house. She meets the children. First, Flora, who is 8 or 9. She's quite angelic, captivating. Then she meets Miles, Flora's brother, who's about 10 years old. And he's even more enchanting. But before we meet Miles, we and the governess learn that he's been expelled from his boarding school with no explanation of why. And this, I think, is really at the heart of the story because this information precedes any ghostly appearances. We learn more of the children's history, though not much, when the governess then begins to see these ghosts or apparitions. One is of a man who appears to be the uncle's valet, Peter Quint, who died somewhat mysteriously about a year ago. And the other is the apparition of a woman who appears to be Miss Jessel, their former governess, who also died shortly after Peter Quint, after a mysterious illness. And these two, Quint and Jessel, were vaguely romantically linked. So the governess comes to believe that the children see these apparitions too, that they don't wish her to know it, that Quint and Jessel are trying to get closer to the children, to possess or destroy them, something the children cannot suspect. And she, the governess, decides she will be the screen. She will protect them. She will save them.
Now, the great question of this book then involves the governess. She's now our narrator
right.
in this story. How reliable is she? Or to put it bluntly, is she bonkers? Right? There's a question about her own sanity. Is she seeing real ghosts or are these hallucinations?
This is a debate about the story that's been raging in the criticism for about 75 years. Edmund Wilson in the 30s was the first to really propound the theory that the governess is disturbed and deluded. And he had a kind of Freudian reading involving sexual repression. You can buy into that or not, but you can certainly make the case that she's hallucinating and that she's lost it. In support of that, you have the fact that she's severely sleep-deprived, by her own admission, that she seems sort of elated or conceited with her power, and that she becomes increasingly single-minded and suspicious of everything as she pursues her theory. Robert Heilman in the 40s said, no, the governess is absolutely right. The ghosts are there. They're real. She is right to try and protect the children. She just doesn't succeed.
So it's a ghost story, maybe. And this is a kind of classic question in a lot of horror literature. Is this a story of supernatural horror, or is it a kind of psychological thriller? Is it deliberately ambiguous?
Absolutely. Those who want to dismiss the governess as just plain unreliable have to confront some details that James plants that I think make it difficult to be sure what's going on. For example, she sees these ghosts or presences, whatever you want to call them. She describes what she's seen to Mrs. Gross, the housekeeper. Mrs. Gross says, that's Peter Quint. That's Miss Jessel. There's no way the governess could know that. At the very end, Miles appears maybe to confess his desire to see Quint's ghost. So, yes, I think James is trying to keep us unsettled.
Now, what are these ghosts up to? Let's assume that they're actually there. What are they doing? They're haunting this place, but they're doing more than just roaming around the hallways of this gothic country estate.
Yes, they appear at strange times and strange places. They appear to the governess, and she believes they appear to the children. They appear in high places or across the reach of a pond or somewhere out of reach, but the governess strongly believes that the ghosts are trying to come closer to the children and to, you know, bridge the gap, basically, of separation between them.
And the kids are totally weird about this, right? The governess wonders if they're seeing things, if they're keeping secrets from her. What's going on with them?
They admit nothing until perhaps at the very end. As to seeing ghosts. Their behavior is childlike, seemingly innocent. What the governess strongly believes, though, that they do see and want to see and commune with these ghosts, and she builds a theory based on their silence. And that's one of the things that's interesting and eerie about this story, is that their lack of discussion of their history, their lack of mention of these former servants, and all that they do not do basically comes to form the governess's theory as to what she's sure they do.
There's a scene where Flora pretty clearly sees Miss Jessel. It seems like she knows that this ghost of Miss Jessel is in her presence, and then she refuses to admit it. Why? What could the children be hiding?
That is very, very hard to say. We know from the housekeeper that the children were fond of these servants and spent a lot of time with them. They have no parent figures. Their uncle is completely uninterested in them. They're orphaned. So perhaps there's a kind of familiarity in these presences. Perhaps there's a fascination. That's a great unanswerable question. I think it taps into an anxiety that the governess feels and that we as readers feel. You want to protect children, and yet there's a strange sense of how do I do it and what's going on? And there's so much to protect them from that we can't know. So I think that's part of the power of the story, is that it's a very basic feeling.
You mentioned Miles was expelled from his school. And he seems like a nice little boy. This is an interesting detail that contradicts what we are seeing on the page, at least initially, from Miles. What's going on with his backstory?
I think that's at the heart of this story, actually. And I think we can become preoccupied debating whether the ghosts are real or hallucinations, but I think the question of Miles is at the heart of the story. What's strange about it is, on the one hand, his schoolmasters say nothing to justify his expulsion, and Miles himself says nothing. So there's this great question. The other thing that's troubling about it to the governess that we might initially miss as 21st century readers is that Miles is a young gentleman. And as a young gentleman, he's meant to follow a kind of code of honor, not to do anything really seriously morally wrong. That he's expelled from school suggests that he's violated that code in some way. And this gets into all these sort of Victorian taboos about sort of class-conscious behavior and moral probity.
So by this point, the governess definitely believes in ghosts. She thinks they're there. How is this affecting her mental state and her relationship with the children?
Not well. She becomes increasingly suspicious of everything that they do and of everything that they don't do, of what they say and what they don't say. Paranoid, I think, is a term we could use. I think it's interesting, she frequently goes and stands in the places where she has seen an apparition, or sits where she's seen one. And I think that, arguably, she does become the most haunting and fearful presence in the children's lives by the end of the story.
We reach a kind of climactic, desperate moment, and they send off Flora. They get her out of that place. Miles remains in the estate with the governess. And let's fast forward to the ending. It's a shocking ending. It's a provocative ending. What happens at the very conclusion of this tale?
Well, as the governess grows in this belief that the children are communing with the ghost, she also grows in her belief that Miles has done something very wicked at school. And so in the final scene, when Flora's gone off, she's sick, she's traumatized, final scene is just the governess with Miles, and she's trying to get him to confess what he's done at school. He confesses that he said things to friends he trusted, and these things were repeated to his masters, who, remember, have said nothing to justify expelling him. Now, in the culture of the story, this kind of Victorian reticence can signify innocence, that is, we don't speak of what's reprehensible. But what about guilt? I think the possible implication becomes that Miles spoke of some wrongdoing, brought to light something his masters wanted hidden. And that's a kind of reversal of point of view that perhaps implicates the governess. Has she been the corrupting force in the children's lives? At this moment, she sees Peter Quint. She grabs Miles.
And Peter Quint is one of the ghosts, the dead valet.
Yes. She grabs him. She thinks Miles does not see him. And she holds him with a kind of passion, as she says, and then finds him lifeless in her arms. We were alone with the quiet day, and his little heart, dispossessed, had stopped.
All right, there's a lot going on in that last paragraph. Do we know, did he die of fright? Did she squeeze him to death? Yeah. What happens at the end of this story?
Okay, perhaps he died of fright. Perhaps she squeezed him too hard. Perhaps he is dispossessed of his connection or communion with this ghost, Peter Quint, something that sustained him in a strange way. And by becoming a screen between Miles and the ghost, the governess has in effect killed him. Perhaps in a sense, though, she's been the one possessing him, and he has kind of eluded her grasp.
That word dispossessed is doing a lot of work there, and we don't entirely know what it means. We think of possession, obviously, and ownership and all kinds of things. But that word is key, how we interpret that word in that final line.
And the strange thing is, in a classic ghost story, you think of possession as the haunting thing. Here at this crisis, this terrible moment of loss, to be dispossessed becomes the striking note. This is classic Jamesian reversal. It's just masterful.
One character we haven't talked about much is a character who's entirely off stage. That's this uncle, this absentee uncle, who is in charge of his orphaned niece and nephew. What do we know about this guy, and what is his role as a kind of haunting presence in the story?
He haunts the governess with his attitude toward the children and toward her. He says, take care of them for me, please. You'll do me a great favor, and I never want to hear from you again. So she goes to the country house, and she begins to fulfill her responsibility. She takes a kind of pride in that, but just before she first sees a ghost, she is thinking to herself, I wish he would appear and know what I'm doing. And she has this desire to be seen and to be known. And it's then that a ghost first appears. So he does haunt the story. You could also say that he, in some ways, establishes the situation that the governess will confront and then disappears from the story, much like an author, if you will.
Okay, Lorraine, so we've got this weird situation in a country estate, maybe haunted, maybe not, an unreliable narrator, a frantic moment at the end, a death at the end. It's a classic ghost story, The Turn of the Screw. Is it scary?
Yes, it is scary. James said that a good ghost story should be heart-shaking. Partly it's scary because we come to care for these children. We see that the governess cares for them, and yet the ghostly creeps in.
The Turn of the Screw was published in 1898, which is about a century after the height of the Gothic novel, which is a genre of literature popular at the end of the 18th century, the start of the 19th century. This comes later. It has a lot of Gothic hallmarks, this big country house, this unreliable, maybe deluded narrator. There are ghosts. First of all, Lorraine, what is a Gothic novel? And is this story Gothic?
Well, in a Gothic novel, strangely enough, you have all the sort of trappings of a ghost story or a horror story. You know, the haunting location, the manuscript locked away, the candle mysteriously extinguished. But by the end of the novel or story, these things have been rationally explained. We do not have a rational explanation at the end of James' story, so it doesn't quite fit the mold. You can see how he's working against that.
A lot of commentators have given this book a kind of Freudian interpretation. It might be worth pointing out this novella publishes right before Freud's heyday, but what is the Freudian interpretation of The Turn of the Screw?
It goes in two directions. The most basic would be that the governess is sexually repressed, that she is, throughout her conduct, trying to please her unseen employer because she's fallen in love with him. I think a more compelling Freudian reading of the story would have to do with the uncanny. And in German, uncanny is unheimlich. And heimlich, as Freud explained in his essay on the uncanny, can mean, in German, either homely and familiar or hidden and secret. And that's the key to the uncanny, is something familiar and yet strange. And in a culture like this late Victorian culture, where reticence is associated with moral purity, a great deal of human experience is necessarily hidden and becomes fascinating and haunting. So the way this plays into the story most directly is in this connection between Quint and Jessel. He is a valet. She's a governess. There's meant to be a class distinction between them, but they've become somehow romantically linked. From a 21st century point of view, nothing could be more natural than that two young unmarried people thrown together should be mutually attracted. But in a repressed or reticent culture, in the view of the story, it's become something nearly unspeakable.
So there's something strange about their relationship and what their agenda might be. Are they trying to corrupt the children? Are there ghosts trying to corrupt the children?
Right. And there's this sense that the governess is afraid of such a connection, and that knowledge of these figures who were romantically linked would be inherently corrupting. Not just that they're ghosts, but that who they were in life was something threatening to the children.
Is this book a novel Is it a novella? Is it a short story? It's not long. It's maybe a long short story. Anyway, where would you classify this?
I'd classify it as a short story because of its great unity of design and because it does exactly what Poe said a short story must do. It has a very intense and unified impact. It makes a strong and distinct impression on the reader. James wrote, by the way, he was a prolific short story writer, and he wrote some 8 to 10 ghost stories throughout his career, though he's best known for his realism.
That's a paradox, isn't it? When we hear about Henry James, it's usually for these long, realistic novels. On the Great Books podcast, we've done shows on Portrait of a Lady, which is episode number 86, and also The Bostonians, which is episode 207. And yet, he also wrote a bunch of ghost stories. I think that a lot of English professors don't share that with their students, or at least not so much. What's going on here? Why is he doing both, do you think?
One thing he said about his ghostly writing is that the ghost story writer has to be most concerned with the effect of a ghostly experience on an ordinary human person like you or me. It's not the question of, are the ghosts real, but how does the perception of a ghost affect a person? And that, I think, is a bridge to his realism. His realism, if you've read much James, is very minute and psychological. Remember, his brother was William James, the great American philosopher and psychologist. And I think what James found is that the more closely you look at reality, especially perhaps the workings of the mind, the stranger it can seem.
Ghosts can be a part of realism, perhaps, in the sense that there may or may not be such a thing as ghosts, but what's 100% true is the notion that people believe in them, that they seem to think they exist.
Absolutely. And if you go through his realist novels looking for uncanny moments, you will find them everywhere, in fact.
What do we make of the title? The Turn of the Screw. There's a suggestion there of mounting pressure, like literally the turning of a screw. There's also a hint of torture, maybe.
Yes, James used the phrase throughout his writing with different connotations, but the application of pressure, of moral pressure, is the common denominator, whether that's good and salutary pressure or a torturing one. There are many turns described in the story, and you get this sense of the way our mind shifts, our view of things shifts. You could also think of the title as pointing to a kind of circling or spiraling motion. You might say the governess experiences that sort of downward spiral into madness throughout the story.
The Turn of the Screw has been adapted many times, perhaps most famously in a 1961 movie called The Innocents. Is that a good movie, Lorraine?
It's a great movie. The screenplay is by Truman Capote. The settings are perfect. It was filmed partly at Sheffield House in England. The cast is perfect. It uses music in a way that is haunting. I think really kind of builds on the story. I think it captures the spirit of the story.
There's a scene in there that I love. It's a scary scene. It's when the character based on Miss Jessel first appears, and she's across a pond from the kids wearing a dark dress. And I remember when I watched that film, it just made me sit up straight. It was I wouldn't call it quite a jump scare in the sense of a modern horror film, but it was really creepy. And it's right out of the book.
It's a haunting image. And what's interesting is there's nothing lurid about it. There are no daggers. There's no dripping blood. James manages, and the film captures this, to make rather ordinary and on the surface unthreatening scenes ominous.
It's in black and white, and it didn't have to be for a 1961 movie, but this I think adds to the haunting, shadowy aspects of the story.
Yes, as I understand it, the filmmakers went to great lengths to capture a kind of moody, blurred framing of scenes that would have elements of dark and light and shadows everywhere.
It's one of the great classic horror movies. More haunting than horrible, I would suggest, but worth watching. Lorraine, how did you discover Henry James as a reader?
I knew James as a novelist from a very young age and loved him, but I'd never read The Turn of the Screw. It was one of those works of his that I knew by reputation. Everybody raved about it. The most haunting, the greatest ghost story, on and on. I thought, it can't be that good. A few years ago, I was working with a student doing a study on Henry James. I read it, and our daughter was quite young at the time. I was often up at night with her. I didn't even want to go downstairs in our house to get a drink of water. It really made an impression on me. So it is as good as its reputation. It's better than its reputation. And what I would say, having read it a few times now, is that it absolutely rewards rereading. You begin to see things. Almost every sentence is just laden with ambiguity and potential double meaning. It's a very artful story.
And where does it fit into the legacy of Henry James? We already discussed him as an important realist novelist, but where does he fit into the story of Anglo-American literature? What is his legacy?
You know, James' legacy is something perhaps neglected or misunderstood. The connection between James and Hawthorne is a very interesting one. We all know that Hawthorne writes about the guilty conscience, the experience of dealing with sin and secret sin and being haunted by one's past. These are classic Hawthorne themes that we associate with The Scarlet Letter and his other works, Young Goodman Brown. James, early in his career, wrote a biography of Hawthorne. And his style is very different from Hawthorne's. That notion of the burden of the past, of being haunted by the past, of the depths of the human conscience as being an important part of our even everyday relations with one another. I think this is a very important part of James' legacy. He brings those themes that we associate with the more sort of American past connected with Puritanism. James brings those themes into the 20th century, really.
Henry James was born in 1843, died in 1916. What's the case for reading him now in the 2020s, more than a century after his death? And in particular, what's the case for reading The Turn of the Screw?
James makes you think, and he makes you think at multiple levels. On the one hand, sometimes you have to think hard just to understand his sentences. His prose is distinctive. I don't know anyone else who writes like that. It can be very difficult. But what you find, if you're willing to sort of engage with the puzzle of his text, is that it unlocks layers of meaning, circles of meaning. It just is very potent writing. Why read The Turn of the Screw? It's just a good story. It's captivating. It will just bring you into a world that is absolutely credible and believable, even though it's ghostly. And as I say, you can read it again and again and just admire it more and more. So it's as James said, I think he was absolutely right. It's pure story.
Lorraine Murphy, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about The Turn of the Screw by Henry James.
My pleasure.
You've just listened to The Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to The Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through my website at heymiller.com. On Twitter, my handle is @heymiller. Last of all, special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of The Great Books Podcast.